Next week marks the 40th anniversary of a Supreme Court decision that guaranteed juvenile defendants the right to an attorney. And yet many teenagers continue to be sentenced without ever speaking to a lawyer. Joining me now for the second underreported segment of today's show are Grace Bauer. Her 13-year-old son was sent to a maximum security facility without ever consulting a lawyer. She's now the director of the Lake Charles Chapter of Families and Friends of Louisiana's Incarcerated Children. Robert Listenby, chief of the Juvenile Unit of the Defender Association of Philadelphia, and Marianne Scally, deputy director of the National Juvenile Defender Center. And I'm very pleased to welcome them all to today's underreported segment. Hi.
Thanks so much for having us.
Grace, why was your son arrested?
He was arrested for shoplifting originally.
And what happened after his arrest? Was he ever asked if he wanted a lawyer?
No, he was never talked to about an attorney, nor did we ever get one.
Is it expected that juveniles know that they can ask for an attorney, but if they don't, then nobody tells them that they can?
I think that in Louisiana, at least, that we do a better job of providing attorneys for kids now than we once did. But I don't think parents don't realize that their children need attorneys because the system represents help to families that they couldn't otherwise get without going into the system. What families don't realize is that once they're involved in the system, a lot of bad things can happen to their children.
Weren't you actually counseled not to get a lawyer?
We were. We actually were. We were told that if we got an attorney, it would prevent my son from getting the help that he needed, that would actually stand in the way of getting to services that we believed he needed.
Marianne, could the same sort of thing have happened if her son were an adult?
If her son were an adult, he could have also been encouraged, but it doesn't happen as often because there's not a parent standing there giving guidance as well as other authority figures. I don't think adults are as swayed as children to waive their right to counsel because they don't know. They look to adults for guidance. And in our system, we have historically told them, don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. The consequences aren't going to be that lifelong for you. And in fact, they are.
Robert, so they're actually waiving their rights, these kids?
Yes, it's fairly common throughout the United States for children to waive their right to counsel because the juvenile system is portrayed as a rehabilitative system. People often assume that the court, the judges, and prosecutors are going to take care of the interests of children, but this is not a fact.
Is there anybody out there to tell them about the possible consequences of waiving their access to a lawyer?
Often there is a form that people have to sign, but it doesn't really describe the consequences of waiving the right to counsel. It doesn't explain that children can be placed in facilities until they're 21 years old in many states, some places 18. It doesn't explain that they will have juvenile records that in many cases will remain with them for the rest of their lives, as in Massachusetts, where there's no right for expungement.
And in some cases, they're sent to adult prisons, aren't they?
Well, in cases where children are sent to adult prisons, they are in the adult system. There are fewer of them who waive their right to counsel.
Well, Grace, what happened with your son? What was his sentence finally?
We were told that he would go into a 90-day treatment program. The program wasn't designed for the needs that he had, though, and so shortly after being put in the program, he was removed from the program and then put into the general prison population at the facility where he was at.
But what were his needs that you feel should have been taken care of?
He had mental health issues, and he had a drug addiction issue, and those needs were never met by that program. This was a boot camp program, not designed to help with the problems that were there, but just to discipline him into shape and make him do the right thing, and it didn't work because the issue still existed. You could make him exercise all day long. It didn't change the fact that he had a mental health problem.
And the Department of Justice was investigating that juvenile facility that he was sent to. Now, he was 14 years old at the time. Did they really think a boot camp approach was going to change him around, turn him around?
Well, at that time in the United States, we were lots of folks were pushing the issue of boot camps. It was a new magic fix, everybody said, and so folks thought it would work. Nobody bothered to research to see if they actually worked. And they were not effective with children that had mental health issues. and substance abuse problems. They were particularly ineffective in those matters.
Now, Marianne, Grace said that her child was then sent to a regular prison. Is that typical for kids 14, 15 years old?
Well, without a defense counsel giving the judge information about a child's needs, there's no one to give that young person a voice in court. So the judge has to make decisions based on the information they have, and without knowing what the child's concerns are, it would be typical that a judge chooses something that is inappropriate for a child. It often occurs when the information isn't brought by defense counsel to the court.
Grace, when did you realize that you needed a lawyer?
When he failed out of the 90-day program and he was put into the general prison population of this youth facility, the Tallulah Correctional Facility, what we learned at that point was that if he couldn't make it in the program, then he had to stay in the Department of Corrections custody till the age of 18.
Well, it must be really a rough situation for a kid under 18 to be in a general prison population. Isn't he prey to every crazy in the prisons?
These were all children in this facility, and what they were prey to was the neglect of the state to take care of them. They weren't being provided the food. They were not being provided medical care. They were not being provided with books and education. There are fights between kids and with guards was rampant at that time in this facility. This is why the Human Rights Organization was there looking at the conditions of confinement, also the Department of Justice. And so what he fell prey to was a system that was falling apart, and he was horribly neglected inside that facility.
What did the first lawyer you spoke to tell you about your parental rights regarding Corey?
That I had none anymore. That the day I left court, I had given up my parental rights to my son. No one ever explained that. A lawyer would have been very helpful in making me understand that that's what I was doing that day, that I, after that day, had no say in the treatment or care of my child.
Now, Robert, I know you don't practice in Louisiana, but is that generally true?
Well, generally, throughout the United States, there are many jurisdictions where children routinely waive the right to counsel. There are solutions to this problem, however. Even in our state of Pennsylvania, about 11% of the children waived the right to counsel prior to 2003. There was an assessment done by the National Juvenile Defender Center, which highlighted this point. As a direct result of that, the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania enacted a series of procedural rules which make it extremely difficult for children to waive the right to counsel, and the number of children waiving the right to counsel has declined significantly since then.
Can cases of this sort be reopened if they appeal on the grounds that they didn't have adequate counsel?
Well, it depends upon the manner in which the right was waived. If the parents and the children were informed about the right and decided to waive it, oftentimes the cases cannot be reopened.
Because also courts have a kind of resistance to open up too many cases, don't they?
They resist opening up old cases, yes, because then you have to bring the complainants back in and try the cases all over again. But where there's a major injustice, there are some ways to at least protect the rights of children who have waived the right without knowingly and intelligently doing so.
My guests are Robert Listenby, chief of the Juvenile Unit of the Defender Association of Philadelphia, Marianne Scally, deputy director of the National Juvenile Defender Center, and also Grace Bauer, who is now the director of the Lake Charles Chapter of Families and Friends of Louisiana's Incarcerated Children as a result to what happened with her child who was sent off to prison. Marianne, how typical is Grace's story?
Waiver of counsel has been looked at by the National Juvenile Defender Center in about 16 states. The assessments that Bob just mentioned are a way that we can take a look at waiver of counsel, and we've seen across each of the states that we've looked at that waiver of counsel happens in varying rates. You know, in some jurisdictions, we've seen it happen as high as 75% or 80% where kids are encouraged to or don't understand the consequences of waiving counsel and proceed and face incarceration and face consequences really not knowing or having a voice or a juvenile defender to explain both to them, their parents, and the court what the child's experiences have been and what their defenses would be.
Should I assume that this is much more common with poor people?
Absolutely, that the impact is, of course, far greater for children who are of low income and far greater for children of color.
Robert, how many juveniles do you represent over the course of a year?
We typically represent between 6,000 and 6,500 children a year in Philadelphia County.
And juvenile arrests account for almost a quarter of the arrests in your state?
I would say approximately that many, yes.
Is that the national average, Marianne?
That juvenile arrests are about a quarter in each state. You know, we do know that arrests are going down for youth and have consistently gone down since the 90s. And yet we still see more and more youth being drawn into the system because of lower level offenses that we as communities have kind of thrown up our hands, and more kids are being pushed into the justice system.
Robert, so what determines whether a youth will be tried as a juvenile or as an adult?
Well, in it varies from state to state. In many states, you have something that's referred to as direct file legislation. So if a juvenile commits an offense that involves violence and a weapon, then that juvenile will automatically be an adult in many states if they're over the age of 15, as it is in Pennsylvania, or over the age of 14 in some other states.
But in Corey's case, he went from being given a 90-day sentence in a boot camp to 4 years in prison.
Well, that's pretty unusual outside of Louisiana, but it is common that children go into placement for short periods of time, and then they get into fights in those placements or have conflicts with staff or other children, and then they get longer sentences. We have indeterminate sentences in juvenile courts, which means that you can start off with 3 months and be there until you're 21 years old, and that might be 5 or 6 years because of offenses that occur while you're in placement. You're there until you completed the program, not until a certain sentence has been served.
But so that's different than adults.
Dramatically
in adults,
different.
You're given 25 years, and if you're not a good prisoner, you wind up staying 25 years. If you're a good prisoner, you get paroled usually a lot earlier.
That's correct. But, I mean, if you look at N. Ray Gault, you'll see a situation where Gault was given 7 years for making allegedly making a lewd phone call to a next-door neighbor.
That's the case that I was talking about earlier.
That's the case you were talking
40
about.
40 years ago, the Supreme Court decided that juvenile defendants had the right to an attorney?
Correct. And if Gault had been an adult at that time, he would have served a maximum of, I believe, 90 days and a fine of maybe $300, $400. But because he was a juvenile, he was subject to indeterminate sentencing, and he was given 7 years. So the system was much harsher than it should have been, and that's what the Supreme Court objected to.
Now, Grace, did you know about this case when your son's sentence went from 90 days in a boot camp to 4 years in prison?
No, and actually what happened, although we didn't realize it at the time, that's why a lawyer would have been, you know, so helpful for us at that time, because although we were told he was going into a 90-day program, the sentence actually was till he was 18 years old. Complete the program and you get out. The thing that no one ever mentioned to us was that no kids had ever completed this program. Very few children had ever completed the program. And in fact, like Mr. Listenby was saying, that there were other offenses. Corey was not charged with additional offenses once he was in there. But that does happen where kids just are not allowed to ever go home. They're in paperwork processing, and these types of things slow it down, so kids are not allowed to return home.
So as a result of your experience, you became an advocate. What does your organization, the Families and Friends of Louisiana's Incarcerated Children, do?
We advocate on behalf of children that are facing detention and state secure care. We also do something a little bit different than most folks do, where we try to empower parents to advocate on their children's behalf on their own. We walk with them part of the way, providing support, and then hopefully are teaching them the things that they need to know to be able to successfully advocate for their children, whether it's on the inside of the facility or in just keeping them in school and keeping them in their own community back home.
Marianne, isn't the number of juvenile arrests declining nationwide?
Absolutely. It's been declining since the 90s, since the late 90s.
For most groups, but not all groups?
For most groups, that's right.
And the exception is African-American youth?
Oh, I wouldn't say that at all. We've seen numbers across all populations for juvenile arrests decrease.
And what happens when they are incarcerated as juveniles? Are these kids likely to be straightened out, or are they candidates for long prison careers?
You know, one of the pieces that we have seen and have better research on now is the fact that community-based programming is so much more effective for youth, and that we see success rates so much higher for kids who are treated in their communities. And we know that without juvenile defense counsel advocating for appropriate programming, that these kids are still being sent to inappropriate, unsuccessful lockdown facilities.
Have things changed, Robert, in your unit in Philadelphia over the last 5 years? Are adjustments being made to the needs of these kids?
We're doing our very best to dramatically change the way we conduct our practice. Specialization has come in for juvenile practices in places where the communities are willing to invest. We have, for example, special education lawyers that handle the unique needs of children who have special education situations.
Is that often a problem? Are these learning disabled kids?
Well, approximately a third of the children who come into the juvenile justice system are in special education. So you need lawyers who understand those unique issues. You need lawyers who understand mental health issues. You need lawyers who are able to handle appellate issues as well. And what you have in America generally is justice by geography. Some places you have lawyers who specialize, in other places you just have a general practitioner who doesn't have the unique knowledge necessary to properly represent these children.
But you also said that in areas where people are willing to fund, we know that public defenders are underfunded practically everywhere in this country. Is it also true with the juvenile defender units?
Not in our situation. I would not say that we're underfunded, as a matter of fact. The City Council of Philadelphia has been, has paid a great deal of attention to our office and provides us with the resources that we need.
Marianne, if my kid became a juvenile defender, are there some places that I would be happier to be living in?
You'd want to live near Bob. They're doing a great job at really encouraging a specialized practice in Philly. And other states are also really trying to ramp up the specialized nature of juvenile defense by allowing people to stay in juvenile court. Many places just use it as a training ground and say, juvenile defense, the consequences don't matter. And what we're really trying to, teach also to the juvenile defense and indigent defense communities is that juvenile defense matters more than almost any other area of practice, and we have to put our best and brightest attorneys there to ensure that our kids get outcomes that we would want for our own child.
Grace, where is your son now?
My son is home and doing very well, thank you.
So, but that is that typical of the situation in Louisiana?
No, I don't think it is. And Corey ended up doing 3 years in an adult facility after coming home from the juvenile facility. So I think a lot of our children end up in adult corrections sooner or later in their lives. And I hate to say that that's the typical thing that we see here.
Well, I've spoken to a number of people who have been incarcerated, and they talk about just how traumatic it was for them. It's very difficult to recover. What did you have to do to stabilize him?
He had to have mental health care on a regular basis. And when you can't get a job, mental health care is a little bit hard to come by. And
he couldn't get a job because he had a prison record?
Because he had a prison record, exactly. And so it makes it very difficult for families to access the services that their people are needing coming out of facilities like this when they don't have a lot of reentry programs. There's no money for reentry for folks coming out of prison. And it just makes it very hard. And so when they don't have a job, they're not able to get the services they need. Plus, their self-esteem is also taking a beating and not being able to get a job and to maintain a style of living,
Well, I'm assuming that Corey was released partly because you became an advocate. What about other kids in Louisiana? Are they faced with similar situations to your son's?
Yes.
The situation hasn't improved.
It has improved because in 2001, when my son was in this juvenile facility, there were almost 2,000 kids in state secure care. Today, there's less than 500 in Louisiana. So in terms of numbers, we've dropped our numbers a lot. But in terms of providing really good community-based services and not having children detained at the local level, we've not done as well at that.
I would just say that many jurisdictions allow for children's records to be expunged to give them a second chance in society. Without expungements, it's difficult for children to go into the military, law enforcement, in some cases to get into college and get loans and that kind of thing. Our office does expungements on a large scale, and we're encouraging other juvenile defenders across the nation to follow suit. Many in Pennsylvania do. Places like Massachusetts, that right is not offered. So children have to keep those records for the rest of their lives, and they are really prevented from getting even jobs at McDonald's. I've had many children come into my office in tears, their parents in tow, just asking me to do something about getting their records expunged because they've been fired from McDonald's or fired from Burger King.
Because they found out that they had a prison
because
record.
Because they had not a prison, a juvenile record, which in theory is dramatic, is completely different from a prison record because they've been in placement for treatment, supervision, and rehabilitation and not incarcerated just for punishment. And it's supposed to help. Also, I just note, in our state, we spend as much as $139,000 a year per child for secure confinement. The goal is to rehabilitate, and we are spending a lot of money towards that end. So society really is trying to do something right in some respects, and I think it ought to be encouraged to do more.
We thank you all so much for being with us today for our underreported segment. Robert Listenby, Chief of the Juvenile Unit of the Defender Association of Philadelphia, Marianne Scally, Deputy Director of the National Juvenile Defender Center, and Grace Bauer, mother of Corey Bauer, and the director of the Lake Charles Chapter of Families and Friends of Louisiana's Incarcerated Children. Thank you again.
Thank you so much for focusing on this.